Good morning. I was preaching a gospel meeting in Alabama a few years back. Probably shouldn't give any more detail than that, just so that you can't locate this brother to either thank him or get on to him. But one of the elders there was making the announcements on Friday night. It was a Sunday through Friday meeting. And as he got up in the opening announcements, he said, "We didn't think it would happen, but Friday has finally arrived." He said afterwards that he meant that in the best way. I'm not exactly sure what the best way you could mean that is. Hopefully he just misspoke. Well, that's where we are today. You may be thinking, finally, we have arrived. We are finishing the series on James this morning. Two verses that we want to look at this morning as we finish this particular series that we have, as we've pointed out all along, addressed as street-level Christianity, just down-to-earth things, things that that James writes that are easily understood, but so very practical that they are not always very easy to put into application. And I would tell you, as he winds this epistle up, he's going to, again, give us something that's easy to understand in instruction, but is most difficult to do. It's a lesson that we've entitled, based on the last two verses, that we've entitled Search and Rescue. You've probably seen stories, as I have, on television from time to time. Somebody is lost. Maybe it is somebody that, in a case like this, has gone off the road and they don't know where the person is. The car is there, the person is not. Maybe it is somebody that has been stranded out on a road because of snowstorms or floods or mudslides or something like that, and they're not sure exactly where they are or how to find them, or somebody that's lost in the wilderness. I don't know about you, but every time they report one of those stories and they show the family making a plea on television for help to find that person, those are just gut-wrenching types of stories. They're difficult. They, especially when it is children that are missing, and they make that announcement. It just, you can feel it. If you're a parent or a grandparent, I mean, at least for me, I literally can feel the upset that is associated with that kind of an announcement. And I mean, that even happens when you're at a place like a large park and you see a child that's lost. Even though you know they're not truly lost, they're in safe condition. Somebody's going to help them find security, but still, just to see the child in that state, and you can feel the pain that's associated with that. Incredible joy when they come on later and say, "This person has been found alive and well." That happened just recently, actually, in two cases that were very similar, one with a good, one with a not-so-good ending. There were, on two separate occasions in Florida just recently, there were kids that were lost at sea. I don't know if you read those stories or not. One of them they found. As a matter of fact, when I opened up the article, it says found at sea. I thought it was talking about, I didn't know there were two cases. So I thought they had found the two 14-year-old boys, when in fact they had not. They called off the search on those two 14-year-old boys. That was right down in the area where we just were, in West Palm, Jupiter area of Florida, where they had taken off. And so the incredible joy when they say, we found these people alive and well. They've been reunited with their family. And yet, incredible pain and sympathy and empathy when you see them come on and announce that they've called off a search, or that the person has not been found, or that the person has been found and the result of finding them was not good. Those are difficult things. What James is going to do in these last two verses of this epistle is talk about the nature of search and rescue as it applies to us. And I would admit it right on the front end. It is one of the most difficult things that God asks us to do. It is an answer to the age-old question. When God went to Cain in the garden, you remember he said, "Where is your brother Abel?" And what was Cain's response? "Am I my brother's keeper?" This is what James is going to answer with an absolutely resounding yes. You are your brother's keeper. We have that responsibility one to another. But it is difficult. In John chapter 6, Jesus is teaching about some things, and it says that many of the disciples left because of the things that he said were hard. Not hard to understand. He didn't ask them, "Are you confused?" when they were struggling with what he was saying. He didn't say, "Do you not understand what I have said?" I don't know if you remember or not. What he asked those who were turning away from him was, "Are you offended?" It wasn't a matter of, "Do you not understand what I'm..." They understood. They didn't like what he said. And I have to tell you, God's Word is that way sometimes. Sometimes it's just harder. It hits me harder. I'm not as fond of what he tells me. It's not as easy to do everything that he asked me to do as it is some of the things that he asked me to do. We struggle with that, and James is going to give us a hard thing. This task of search and rescue, our responsibility toward brethren, is not an easy task. It's like trying to rescue a wounded dog. I don't care how gentle you are. I don't care what your intent is, how loving and caring you are very likely to be scratched or bitten when trying to rescue a wounded dog. No matter how much you're trying to help. It doesn't always go well when we're trying to rescue our brethren either. I saw a video that somebody posted the other day. I don't know if you saw this or not, but it was some people that were rescuing a pelican. Growing up in Florida, the situation that they were showing in the video, I've seen repeatedly in Florida. When you're fishing in Florida and lines break in the water and pelican are going after fish, many times they'll get tangled up in that fishing line. Or on more than one occasion have I seen somebody on a pier casting a line out through the air with a bait on it to land in the water when a pelican swoops down and takes the bait and there's a hook in the line. You cut your line, but now the pelican's got a hook in him, and depending on what happens to that line, that's what happened to this pelican. He's hooked, and the line is wrapped around his bill. He has no chance of eating in the situation that he's in. But I'm telling you, it was a thrashing for those that grabbed that pelican and were trying to get the line off of him. He wasn't a bit happy about trying to be saved. I would tell you, that's going to happen when we reach out sometimes to those who have wandered away. It isn't always pleasant, but it's something that God says we need to do because we are on His search and rescue team. And I just want us to see 2 points. Read with me, if you would, James chapter 5, starting in verse 19. "Brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." 2 points with some subpoints under them that I want you to see, and the lesson will be yours. Easy to understand what he says? Yeah, remarkably easy to understand what he says. Easy to put it into practice? Not nearly so. It's a difficult thing to have a confrontation with somebody else over sin. For a multitude of reasons, it becomes difficult. But I think he wants us to see a couple of things here. One is that Christians do stray from the truth. True Christians, people who have given their life to God, stray from the truth. There's an entire doctrine that exists under the umbrella of Christianity in our world that says no true Christian ever walks away from God. I don't think that that's the case. I think James is dealing with that here. And here's what he says. He says, "My brethren, if any among you," any of you as brethren, any of you that are Christians, those that have a relationship with God, having a relationship with God does not prevent me from choosing to walk back into the path that I have come from. Any more than the Israelites coming in or out of the land of Egypt would have prevented them from going back into the land. They wanted to go back when things got tough when they were going. We understand that that happens. Christians, those who have given their life to God, do stray back away from God. And he wants us to understand that actually that happens a couple of different ways. That happens morally and it happens doctrinally. I want you to look at what he says again. If anyone among you wanders from the truth, he says that's a doctrinal thing. James, multiple times in this letter, deals with the idea of the truth. He says in chapter 2, verse 14, "What use is it, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but has no works? Can that faith save him?" And then he goes on to state that faith without works is dead. He indicates to them that there is a the truth issue. He says in... Oh, I lost my verse there. He says in chapter 1, when he's talking about us being one to God by the truth. There is an absolute. We live in a world that says there is no absolute truth. But God says there is a truth. There is a truth, and it's possible to wander from the truth. There are things that are doctrinal that God expects us to hold to. Things that are truth in an absolute nature. Things that help us to understand establishing a relationship with Him. Things that help us understand having a relationship with Him that continues. As we watch an announcement just recently on television regarding marriage in this country and the nature of approval of same-sex marriage. God has a truth on the subject of marriage, and it doesn't alter because society chooses to alter it. There is an absolute truth on marriage. There is an absolute truth on many of the things that God deals with. I remember when I was in school, I had to take a class called Situation Ethics. Joseph Fletcher wrote a book about that. It's the idea that ethics change depending on the situation. So in other words, it is okay to lie if lying prevents a greater evil. Well, we've raised a generation of people that have been convinced that situation alters truth. It's never absolute. It is fluctuating with the situation. But James is saying that is not true. That it is possible to stray from the truth. There's an absolute truth. And that's why he says we have to live the way that God asks us to live. In 1 John chapter 3, John writes these words, "Little children, make sure no one deceives you. The one who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous." And so it isn't only a doctrinal issue, it's a moral issue as well. And so what he says is, and the words that he uses in the Greek here, carry both of those ideas. If anyone wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way, those two phrases carry in the Greek, carry both ideas. They couple them together. And I think James couples them together because of this. When you wander from the truth, you are very likely to wander morally as well. In other words, when I leave the truth of something, and it actually works in almost a circular nature, because many times people wander from the truth because they have wandered morally. And so I'm going to alter what I believe to be true based on how I'm living. And John is saying, do you not understand? There is a righteous way to live. And only the person that's living righteously is right or righteous. There is a way to live, a moral way to live. But he says it is very possible that you can err and you can leave God once you're there. Look at the parable of the sower or the soils in Matthew chapter 13 and see if that is not exactly the idea. Who's he talking to here? He's clearly talking to those that are Christians and about those that are Christians. This is not evangelism that he's talking about. This is familial intervention that he's talking about. These are people who have already been a part of the family. In that parable where Jesus talks about the casting of the seed, evangelism is the casting of the seed on the ground. And sometimes that works. But sometimes it doesn't. He said sometimes it lands on ground that is so hard that it's by the side of the road, and nobody responds to it at all, and the birds come and pluck it away before the seed ever germinates at all. Those people never establish a relationship with Christ. But he says there are those that establish a relationship with Christ, such as those on the rocky soil, and they sink their roots in, but they can't get very deep. And And so what happens? He says things get tough. Life happens. And they find out that being a Christian doesn't make you immune from trials, as James has already said. You may fall into many trials even though you're a Christian. But he says your roots aren't deep enough, and so the temptations and the trials of this world, they just kind of burn you up so that you blow over. When we were in Florida just last week or week before last, when we were in Tampa, they were just inundated with rain. Rains that were significant. 6 inches in 2 hours at my brother's house the day we went out to see him. That's a lot of rain. 10 inches in 4 hours just north of where we were. That was flooding out incredible amounts of area. But one of the things that you noticed when that happened was there are trees that are toppled over, not blown over. Their roots are shallow enough that they can no longer stand at all. And the tree just fell. Big trees. But they have shallow roots, and so they just topple over. Matthew says that that's exactly what happens when Jesus is telling this parable. Or he says there are others that get rooted more deeply, but you know what? As Satan, the enemy, keeps throwing things in front of us, he says there's the deceitfulness of riches and the world and all the things that are clamoring for our attention. He said some get choked out by that. That's what James is talking about. He's saying, understand, this is Christians that we're talking about, and it is serious what we're talking about. In verse 20, he says, this is very serious. He's talking about saving a soul from death. Large oak tree that fell just close to her dad's house, just maybe a half a mile or so from her dad's house, toppled over. That tree will die. It's past saving now. You can't take a tree that size, pick it back up, replant the whole thing. He's saying we need to understand what we're talking about is brothers and sisters. Brothers and sisters who are dying. That's what intervention is all about, isn't it? He says, can you imagine that you had a brother or sister in the flesh that was involved in something that was going to surely destroy their life? Maybe they were involved in some kind of drug abuse or alcohol abuse, or maybe they were involved in some kind of illegal activity that was going to very likely bring about the end of their life. What kind of brother or sister would we be if we just sat by and said, you know what, they're going to die, but I'll just leave that up to somebody else? That's what James is trying to do. He's saying this is what makes it tough. Not tough to understand, but very difficult to put into practice. And then he makes the second point that he's making for us. Not only do Christians stray from the truth, he says it is critically important that we understand that searching and rescuing is everybody's job. When he addresses this, who's he addressing it to? My brethren. Generically. My brethren. And then he says, and one turns him back. Not to the leaders of the churches I write. Not to the one who is preaching the gospel I write. He says, brethren, it is critically important that we understand he starts with a relationship. Brother to brother, brother to sister, sister to sister. He says, understand, I'm talking to a family where there are some family members that are lost and in danger of dying. So whose responsibility is that? That is everybody's responsibility. He says, my brethren, he said, when one turns him back. In Galatians chapter 6, turn there with me if you would. Galatians chapter 6. Paul writing to the church at Galatia, to all of the church at Galatia. When he writes this initially, he's writing it to the churches in Galatia, in that whole region. And he says, brethren, again, to me it's critical that James and Paul both start this conversation with, let's establish the family relationship. Brethren, be like calling a meeting of your family. Family, I need you to know something. If a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, he says. Brethren, you who are spiritual, he says. Who is that? I mean, it almost would sound boastful for you to put yourself in that classification, wouldn't it? You know what? I'm one of the spiritual ones. He's just saying, those of you that understand the danger, those of you that have matured, those of you that find your feet on solid ground in your relationship with Christ, because it isn't always that way. There are times that everybody needs help and assistance, but he says, at this moment, if you're one of the ones who finds yourself planted, you find yourself maturing in your relationship with Christ, you're drawing in, brethren, you who are spiritual, you who are grown, how many of us fit that description? Many. You who are grown, you who are maturing, you who are spiritual, restore somebody that's caught in a trespass. Love that description too. When Paul writes to them, he says, you understand the way sin works? There are a lot of people caught in trespasses that would like to be out. They don't know how. He says, you who are spiritual, you return somebody. Do you feel inadequate to do that? I remember when Matthew first applied with the fire department. They go through a whole interview process, and I remember him being told before that interview process, they'll ask you questions like, don't know if they asked him this specific question, no, I never asked him, but they'll ask you questions like, if you are driving by or you come upon a scene where there is a building that's burning, what do you do? They're interested to see, is it bravado that you're most interested in, or is it what's right and safe that you're most interested in? So they don't really want people to say, you know what, I'd dash in the building, see if anybody's in there. What they would rather you say is, I'm not equipped for that. I don't know what to do. I would find somebody that knows, or I would call 911, or I would get a fireman and bring him in. You may feel inadequate to bring somebody back, but anybody can dial 911. Even if you're inadequate, find somebody that is mature. Speak to those that are your spiritual shepherds and say, I'm really concerned about my brother who is straying from the truth. Would you please help me restore them? Let me know what I can do. What is it that we can do in order to bring them back? All of us are on the rescue team together. It becomes critical that we fulfill whatever role we can. How many times has the person who couldn't do any more than just place the 911 call been directly responsible for the saving of somebody's life because those who were the responders got there in time because somebody called? He says, we have to do something. We are on that rescue team. And that requires two things. That requires both search and rescue. These people aren't coming to you looking to be saved. These are people who have chosen to walk away, who have been caught in the world. We need to have the mindset of Jesus that we are seeking people, that I understand. Have you ever seen a little child? We mentioned before, a child lost it somewhere like a Disney World or something. You ever seen a child that was lost or away from their parents that didn't know they were lost? Now, they're going to cry soon because they're going to realize it sooner or later. But sometimes you see the child all by themselves and you think, there's no parents around. They're about to realize something. We have brethren that do not know that they are in the danger they are in. It says we need to search for them, to seek them out, to make sure we're doing. And rescue is because they don't always know how to find their way back. When Paul talks about being caught in a trespass, sometimes you just get wrapped up. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to correct this. Maybe they're ashamed of what they've done and they don't have any idea whether or not they would be accepted or not accepted when they come back. They need to be assured of God's love and God's forgiveness. They need to be directed back in. Maybe they've got a confused sense of direction because Satan has presented to them this scenario in which they really don't understand what it is they're doing or what they are supposed to do. And what they need is somebody to go out, take them by the hand, and lead them back to where they need to be. In our class this morning, we get to talk about Paul, Saul of Tarsus, and his conversion. Great picture in that passage of Saul being led. He was blinded, so he was led. Well, that's what happens in the world. Sometimes people are blinded to what they're doing, and so they need somebody to find them and somebody to take them by the hand and lead them back to the way. That's what James is dealing with. Is it easy? It isn't easy. But he tells them there are things here that you're trying to accomplish. There's a purpose in all of this. Threefold. He says, one, he says it is to restore them to the truth. That's critical. There is nothing more important either in reaching out to a Christian who has strayed or even evangelistically. There is nothing more important than the truth. We need to get them back within the truth, so that they would understand where they are. Chapter 1, verse 18 is the passage I was looking for before, where he says, in the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth. That's where you're trying to get them back to. They have been duped by something. They've been led away by their own desire, James tells us earlier. But they've walked away from the truth. In chapter 3, verse 14, he also says, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. You're trying to get them back to that body of what is right. That is critical. They need to understand that. We need to understand that. Secondly, he says, it's to save a sinner from death. Nobody has ever run into a burning building and pulled me out, thereby saving my life. That's happened to other people. I know those that are now and have before served as firemen and first responders, those kinds of positions, that they can tell you incidents like that. Those that have been on the battlefield can tell you about incidents where somebody runs in and pulls somebody out of a situation physically, thereby saving their life. I can't even imagine what kind of gratitude would exist between the one saved and the one who has pulled them to safety. Can't you just imagine what that must feel like? But somebody has spiritually done exactly that for me. Pulled me from a life that was leading to death spiritually into the safety of a relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's what he says. Understand what you're doing is saving somebody from death. Some decisions, physically, some decisions you could get people to alter and it may make a slight change in their life. But he's talking about death. Death. Understand that there's a purpose in here. Get them back to the truth and save them from death. And thereby, he says, thirdly, covering a multitude of sins. So, as you understand, that's what you've done. That's not a merit issue. That's not like God saying, you know what, Mark, you've got a pretty messed up life, so if you can just get somebody else to come to the Lord, I'll kind of forget about the things you've done. You've somehow merited credit with me. He's not talking about that. I think he's talking about, like the psalmist says, when you receive transgression, he says, your sin is covered. And I think that's what you've done for this brother. All these sins that have led this brother away, because once they sin and walk away from the Lord, that just compounds itself. And they get more and more involved in whatever it is that is causing that separation. Whether it's just pride or selfishness, whether it's something that is just improper or immoral, he says, you just keep adding. You're doing the same thing over and over and over again. Think about all this. He says, but you've restored this person to the truth. You have helped them to eliminate this incredible amount of sins. Sins that are forgiven are covered, God says. That you've covered. Which means what? I don't know if you saw the Lord of the Rings movies or not. I'm a big fan of the books and the movies. But I remember on one particular occasion, Frodo and his good buddy, Samwise Baggins, or Frodo Baggins and Samwise Gamgee, are heading down toward Mordor, which is an awful place. And they slip and they slide. If you saw the movies, you may remember this scene. They slip and they slide. And all of a sudden, there's this huge army of the evil ones that are marching by. They're sliding down this hillside. Rocks are falling. And they throw a cloak over themselves that cloaks them from the vision of the others. It's just a great scene. Because they are in incredible danger. Surely would have been death, but they have now been covered. That's a great picture. Because those that are looking to destroy them can't see the sin, or can't see the individuals anymore. I think that's what he's saying about sin. This is a beautiful picture. All that sin. Even though Satan's wanting to look and he can talk about it all he wants, when you come back and you receive the forgiveness of God, God's looking down and saying, I don't see it. I don't see it. Where is it? It's been covered. It's important to understand and to help others understand. That's the forgiveness of God. The complete removal of the guilt of that sin and that sin itself from their life. James says, brethren, if anybody strays from the truth, understand, it's your job, it's my job. We're on the search and rescue team. May we always perceive it that way. Incredible that in the last two verses of this short epistle that he could give us possibly one of the hardest instructions that he could give. But he says, it's great news when you can bring somebody back. And the picture in Luke chapter 15, when you have that son who's wandered away and the father receives him back, when he comes back all broken and before his God, incredible party. Just an incredible party. And God talks about one sinner who repents and comes to him, the angels in heaven rejoice. Wouldn't you love to hear that sometime? The heavenly host rejoicing and singing to God. He says, that's what happens. One person. Wouldn't you love to make the heavenly host rejoice? Do what you can to help those who are straying to come back to the Lord. If you're a Christian and have strayed from the Lord, how great a message is that, that He will grant to you total, absolute forgiveness, restore you completely to where you were. What a great message. If you've never come to Him before and have lived a life, even if it's horrendous behind you, He says, same promise. Every bit of it, every bit, wiped completely clean to walk in newness of life. That's the nature of being buried with Him in baptism and raised to live that new life. If you've never done those things and you understand that to be the truth, we hope you'll take care of it today. If you haven't studied that, don't understand that, talk to us. We'd love to share with you more what He has to say. If we can help you today, let us know while we stand and sing.